is case number 68994, DeLucci versus Songer. It's Levine for the appellate, Mr. Guerin for the respondent. Mr. Levine.
Thank you. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Mr. Levine, if we can start with both counsel. We had a recent Supreme Court case on the anti-SLAPP statute, Shapiro. I don't know if you've had a chance to read it, both of you, if you have any comments on it.
I have, and
okay.
I'll be addressing it through the course of my argument.
Okay. I might add that's pending rehearing, so it's the court has not ruled on the petition for rehearing.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you. May it please the justices. Firefighter paramedic Raymond DeLucci and firefighter EMT Tommy Hollis were dismissed from their employment with Pahrump Valley Fire and Rescue Services as a result of an investigation and report by the defendant, which accused them of a number of very serious grounds of misconduct, including refusal to care for a woman with a life-threatening condition, offering to take her to an inappropriate medical facility for their own personal convenience, dishonesty in an attempt to cover up their wrongdoing, and engaging in acts of intimidation directed at the woman and her husband. After 4 days of arbitration testimony, an arbitrator determined that they did not conduct or act as they were alleged to have done by defendant Songer. Following that finding by the arbitrator, DeLucci and Hollis filed suit for both defamation and intentional infliction of emotional distress. That case was dismissed under the anti-SLAPP statutes, where the district court found that Songer's statements constituted a good faith communication in furtherance of the right of petition or free speech in direct connection with an issue of public concern. The district court should not have applied the anti-SLAPP statute. She should not have gotten as far as she did. She ultimately determined, without any findings or explanation as to how she reached her conclusion, that DeLucci and Hollis failed to demonstrate a probability of success by clear and convincing evidence, but she shouldn't have gotten that far, because the anti-SLAPP statutes do not and should not be applied to conduct of statements that are made under a contract of hire. This was addressed, of course, in my brief, the case out of Massachusetts, Coburn versus Gaspard, which says that anti-SLAPP statutes do not apply to contract of hire or vendors because they are not speaking in connection or in a First Amendment context. And the California Court of Appeals has also reached the same conclusion in the Erickson GE Mobile case, noting that where actions are related to performance of contractual obligations and are not motivated by a desire to promote or advance the right of free speech, the anti-SLAPP statutes have no application.
How do you distinguish those cases from our own cases? If you can distinguish them, John versus Douglas County, you're familiar with that case.
I am. I would say that I don't think the court directly addressed that subject in the Douglas County case. They didn't look at the issue of, is somebody acting to speak on petitioning the government under the petition right or acting and speaking on a matter of direct connection of public concern. When you act as a vendor or a contractor, the California Court of Appeals clearly stated it is absurd, that's the word they use, absurd to extend anti-SLAPP to actions of the party that relates to the formation or performance of a contractual obligation.
Do they make any distinction, though, in terms of, I understand what you're saying, but when it involves quasi-government?
I don't know if there would be a distinction under quasi-government, but this would not be quasi-government. If we go back to the Douglas County case, there was an internal investigation in that case, but it wasn't being done under a contract of hire, and I think there were, again, I think it's a very fact-specific case, but there may have been distinguishing factors.
Because normally, paramedics, whatever, operate under a franchise agreement or whatever in their area that's given by the local entity.
Oh, correct. But I think there's a distinction, Justice Douglas, which is a paramedic may be operating under a contract with a local government employer. But what we're talking about when not extending anti-SLAPP to vendors is the person who is making the speech, not the person who is conducting the EMT.
I understand, but you view it in a slightly different light depending on the totality.
As the Massachusetts case noted, every case is going to turn somewhat on its facts.
But aren't we a little looking at it from, say, California more so than Mass, because that's pretty much where our jurisprudence
is. I agree, but the California Court of Appeals was even stronger than the Massachusetts court, saying it is absurd to apply this to performance of a contractual obligation. And that is what has been done in this case. Pat Songer was not petitioning the town of Perump for anything. The only thing he wanted from the town of Perump was to be paid for his services. Likewise, this was not a matter in direct connection, a matter of public concern.
Now, how can you say that when you've got concerns about your fire and rescue unit that essentially protects this town of Perump, and if there's allegations that have been made, how can you say it's not an issue of public concern?
Because the California courts, in the cases I have cited, and which you cited in the more recent Shapiro versus Well case, says that public concern can't be a broad, amorphous public concern. Anything the government does can be brought within the rubric of a broad, amorphous public concern. Of course, it's important that an individual firefighter do their job, but that is not what was meant, and that's what the California courts have held, is not the appropriate analysis for a public concern. It must be a concern relating to a substantial number of people. Personnel matters, and this was clarified before our own legislature in connection with the most recent 2015 amendments. Michael Langhorne, a subject matter expert who testified in front of the legislature, pointed out the distinction. If there's a labor dispute at a casino, that is a matter of public interest because it is abroad, affects large members. And then he gave the example. However, if there's a dispute regarding my job performance, I'm accused of drinking on the job when I'm not, that is not a matter of public interest. In fact, if you were to take a look at the statute regarding public records, open meeting laws, matters of performance by government employees fall outside the public meeting laws. They can be held in closed session. If you were to make a public records request for an internal investigation of the sort that occurred in this case, you won't get it. They're going to say it's a personnel matter. It's outside the realm of the public records laws. Whether firefighter Hollis and DeLucchi did on one individual occasion in connection with their job simply doesn't rise to the level of public interest within the definition applied by the California courts, which has at least been provisionally adopted by this court in the Shapiro versus Well case, understanding that it is under reconsideration.
Doesn't the public have a right to know what kind of service is going to be rendered in their geographic area if it's under some kind of contract?
They have a right to know what the services are, but in individual actions in connection with performing that service,
like as you say that, could it be any other way to understand what services are going to be rendered?
The services that are going to be rendered are basic paramedic and EMT services and firefighter services.
Okay, and with that, does the public not have a right to understand how it's going to be administered?
Oh, how it's going to be administered, yes, but does the individual performance on a given circumstance or a given call that firefighters should have done X instead of Y.
And as you say that, how do you separate the two for the public to understand what they're going to get or not get?
Because if it is an individual personnel matter, as Mr. Langhorne testified to the legislature in 2015, it doesn't affect the broad scope of services that are provided by a local government employer. Discussions about, are we going to contract statements made in connection with a public forum, are we going to contract it out? Is it a good idea to have an outside service provide fire and rescue as opposed to having our own internal people? Those are issues of public concern. But what firefighter DeLucchi or firefighter Hollis does on the night of May 25, 2013 does not rise to that level.
If the public thinks that they're paying for one thing and getting another, is that not of public concern?
I don't think it rises to the broad level of the sort that is contemplated by the statute. For example, communication made in direct connection with an issue of public interest in a place open to the public or in a public forum under the statute, that falls within the scope of the statute. A private internal affairs investigation, and that's what it is. It's internal. It's not external. It's not a public investigation. It is not a truth-finding commission or a truth and reconciliation commission being run by the town board of Pahrump. It's an internal investigation, which is a personnel matter, which is historically and under all of our other laws considered private in nature. Moving on to the next step, the district court never adequately explained how she reached her conclusion that we did not provide sufficient evidence to prevail under the clear and convincing evidence standard. Now, I believe it is no longer the clear and convincing evidence standard and that we are entitled to the benefit of the legislative change, walking it back to the standard used by California under the 2015 amendments. But even under the clear and convincing evidence standard, no explanation has been given as to how we failed to meet our burden. We put forth the same testimony that allowed the arbitrator to conclude they did not do what they were accused of by Mr. Songer, and there is no reason to believe then that if that same evidence were presented to a trier of fact, the result would be any different.
Mr. Levine, do you feel in this case, after reading Shapiro, that the case has to be remanded for the court to do the Shapiro analysis on the various components of anti-SLAPP, or is the do you feel that the facts are sufficiently established here? We can rule on it as a matter.
I don't believe it would need to go back because of the issue of the not applying to the vendor. But if you found that it does apply to vendors, I think the facts are sufficient that you can just reverse without remanding for additional findings. But at a minimum, it would have to. If you disagreed and you felt that the district court did need to analyze it and issue better findings, it would have to be remanded. I'd like to.
You have 4 minutes left.
Thank you. Mr. Garrett.
Good afternoon. I'm Joe Guerin. I'm here for respondent Pat Songer. Thank you for your time. Mr. Songer, at the time of this investigation, was the director of emergency services for Humboldt General Hospital. He'd never done an investigation before. And he was hired by Ms. Brew, and if you look at his declaration, which we've included in the record, volume one, the appendix beginning at page 32, he says, I was asked to review the facts that had already been gathered by the Fire Chief Scott Lewis and Lieutenant Scott Moody, and to conduct additional interviews as necessary to complete an investigation of the incident of June 27, 2012. So if you look at what he was asked to do and what he actually ultimately produced, it was within the exact instructions that he got from Attorney Brew. So the matter proceeds through the arbitration, and the employees are reinstated, and then this complaint's filed, and based on the report that he prepared, the allegations are that somehow there was a defamation, but there's no specific allegation that there were statements made without knowledge of falsehood, and then also intentional infliction of emotional distress. So if you go back to the declaration again, and I want to highlight the point that there's no knowledge of falsehood. Songer was acting in good faith, and in his declaration, paragraph 7, he says, in my investigation, I believe I collected all relevant information that was reasonably available to me. Number 11, as an investigator, I acted in good faith. Paragraph 16, I performed these tasks to the best of my ability in good faith, and I did not disseminate information I knew to be false. 18, 19, and 20, the information contained in my reports was truthful to the best of my knowledge. I made no statements I knew to be false. I am unaware of any facts in the report being incorrect. I still believe the information contained in my reports is accurate, truthful, and supported by the evidence revealed in my investigation. Number 20, I had no knowledge or belief that any information provided the town clerk was false. Now, in responding to an anti-SLAPP motion, once we establish that it's right for consideration, under the 2013 version of the statute, plaintiff was required to come forward and show clear and convincing evidence of a likelihood of prevailing. And they couldn't do that because there's no evidence showing anywhere that anything that Songer did was false. In fact, everything that Songer said was that he was doing what he thought was right, and it was to the best of his ability and in good faith. There was no request in the trial court for additional discovery to take his deposition. There was no 56F affidavit filed. Troy versus Ameristar makes it clear if you want to do discovery on something like that, you have to make that request, and it wasn't made.
Mr. Guerin, could I interrupt your comments? Mr. Levin has suggested to this court that the holdings in the Massachusetts Court of Cobran are consistent with or the same as the California approach in Vargas and Equilon entertainment versus consumer cause. Would you comment on whether you agree with that, and if not, could you distinguish the two?
Sure.
It appears as though those states take different approaches to who the anti-SLAPP statute applies.
Sure. This court on two occasions has said that when we're interpreting the anti-SLAPP statute, we should look to California. First in the John case, and then again most recently in Shapiro. The court said, let's look to California. The court has never said, let's look to Massachusetts. And I think that it's universally understood that Massachusetts is a very narrow interpretation of the SLAPP statute. In contrast, California and then also Washington, I think the court could look at as well, the statute's interpreted broadly. And I think that there's evidence in the record to show that the 2013 amendment was intended to clarify that. If you look at the Virgos versus McNeil case, which is 146 Cal App 4th, 1387, the issues under review via an official proceeding authorized by law were determined to be protected, and the grievant officer's actions were furthering the right of petition, and so the anti-SLAPP motion was affirmed in that case. And basically what happened was an employee alleged harassment. The department had, pursuant to the procedures in place at the University of California, investigated and determined that there was no substantial evidence to support the claim of harassment. So the employee sued, the investigator got sued, or the department head got sued, and it was the anti-SLAPP motion was granted. And in essence, that's what's going on here. The way that the collective bargaining agreement was set up, when the Choice family came in and they made a complaint, some things happened and there was a conflict, so they outsourced the investigation, which they're entitled to do. And Sonder comes in, he's asked to do specific things, he does those things, and he prepares a report which he disseminates in good faith. There's no evidence to contradict any of that. So, to your question, I think that we have to look at California, and if you look at the Burgos case, that's right on point with what's happening here. So, in the trial court, we first, our obligation was to show that, number one...
Justice Givens asked Mr. Levine whether we could decide this case without having to remand it under... his view of the Levine's view of the case. Do you agree that the record is such that this court could decide the case without remand under your view of the law? That is to say that there was an insufficient showing once the burden had shifted, assuming that the anti-SLAPP statute applies.
I think that the record is complete and that the court can affirm based on what's here. This is why. We were able to show that sections 41.637 sub 2 and sub 3 applied. And the court first made a finding that those sections of the statute were satisfied. That shifted the verdict. And at that point, the court had to look at what substantial evidence does the plaintiff have to show by a clear and convincing standard that there was a probability, a likelihood of prevailing. And there wasn't any. And the biggest problem with the plaintiff's case was the litigation privilege. And the court, again, in Welt versus Shapiro, had the opportunity to look at the litigation privilege. And in essence, what it says is that claims that are based on statements made in the course of judicial and quasi-judicial proceedings are absolutely privileged. And for the privilege to apply, it first, number one, must be contemplated in good faith and under serious consideration. That's what happened here. This is the exact issue that the arbitrator was looking at. In determining what to do with these employees was what was their conduct. And what evidence was presented by the town was part of it was Mr. Saunders' declaration. And that was the reason that they justified the termination. And there's no evidence to show anywhere that his investigation was other than in good faith. But the second point is the communication must be related to the litigation. And his communication, it's a quasi-judicial proceeding, but his report and his testimony, that's all protected because it was offered in good faith. He wasn't there to try and benefit, to try and get these guys fired so that he could make money. He was hired as an investigator, and he did what he thought he was supposed to do that. In Cusinetta versus Deloitte Touche, which is 129 Nevada Advanced Opinion 35, a 2013 case, the court again wrote, the absolute privilege, and I'm paraphrasing, was created to protect certain types of communications because the public interest in having public speak freely outweighs the risk that an individual will occasionally abuse the privilege by making false and malicious statements. So even false and malicious statements that are occasionally made, the court recognizes that in the context of this absolute privilege, but you know what, sometimes things might fall through the cracks. And I'm not saying that's what happened here, but it's just should underscore the fact that this is a broad, broad privilege and it applies here. So Saunders' declaration, it was offered in the trial court. And again, the judge looked at it, considered it. I've read the provisions, I think, pertinent to the court's decision today. He was acting in good faith. There's nothing to refute his declaration. There's no competing declaration. And again, there was no request to do discovery to take his deposition to somehow explore that. So based on the record that's before the court, there's enough here for the decision to be affirmed, and it should be affirmed.
Was there any discovery, depositions or otherwise, by the plaintiffs? To refute the declaration.
No discovery was taken and no request was made. Let me talk just generally about the alleged misrepresentations that they rely on in suggesting that the communication was other than in good faith. They referred to the arbitrator's decision and the characterization, the arbitrator's characterization of the report. And the arbitrator basically notes that Saunders should have gone out and personally interviewed everyone, all these witnesses. He didn't. And if you look at the language of his report, it doesn't say, I personally interviewed these witnesses. There's nothing like that to support that. He reviewed statements, and that's what he was hired to do. The last point I want to talk about generally is the preclusion issue. The court noted it in the synopsis, and just so it's covered, in order for the preclusion issue to apply based on the arbitration decision, the issues decided in the prior litigation must be identical. That's not the case here. The arbitration was an employment issue. They were seeking reinstatement. This case is the general allegations are defamation and intentional infliction of emotional distress. And the litigation privilege. None of that was considered in the arbitration. The second one, there has to be privity between the party claiming and my client. There is no privity. Mr. Saunders was essentially an investigator. He wasn't representing anyone in the entire proceeding. There was an attorney who was representing, Ms. Brew was representing the city of Corral. And so there's no connection there. And then lastly, the issue decided was actually necessarily litigated. The issue decided in the underlying case was whether the termination was appropriate. That's totally different than what's being argued here. And the argument here is that somehow he was defaming and intentionally inflicting emotional distress to these plaintiffs. So unless the court has other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Garrett.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Levine, when you're coming up, perhaps you could tell us succinctly what the evidence is of the defamation and the intentional infliction of emotional distress by Mr. Saunders that she would be presenting, assuming we were going to trial on this now. Can you just kind of summarize it from your point of view?
Absolutely. First and foremost, let me address that in connection with a question asked by Justice Hardesty. Did I do any discovery? No, because I didn't need to. Because I had sworn testimony under oath from the arbitration proceeding where I cross-examined Pat Saunders, and he testified, and we had a reporter's transcript, that he did not interview the choices. And as the arbitrator found, his report contained intentional, that's the arbitrator's finding, and material misrepresentations to make it appear that he interviewed the choices and made determinations based upon the information provided by them when in fact he did not do so. That in the words of the arbitrator, he covertly relied upon the chief's hearsay notes and wrote a report to make it appear as if he had actually conducted a full investigation. The factual allegations supporting a charge of defamation are deliberately neglecting the care of a woman with a potentially life-serious condition. That was false because all of the evidence from the arbitration hearing established that James Choice got in his car, dropped into gear, drove away yelling F Desert View Hospital before they had a chance to properly assess the woman. the accusation that they were dishonest in their account and committed a cover-up. That is defamation. The accusation that they decided to take her or offer to take her to Desert View, which is an inappropriate hospital for their own personal convenience, that is defamatory. That they engaged in acts of intimidation against the choices. Pat Songer conceded under oath. When I cross-examined him, I don't know why I put that in there. I don't know. There is no basis for that. He acknowledged it. In other words, I didn't need to conduct more discovery because I had all of the evidence from the underlying arbitration proceeding, and that evidence was found sufficient by an arbitrator to determine the issue, which is, did DeLucchi and Hollis engage in the activities which Songer alleged that they did? And the arbitrator found, no, they did not. And that is why issue preclusion applies. Because it is the same issue. Did they do what they were accused of doing? That is what the arbitrator heard evidence on and made findings on. You do have privity. You have privity of contract. The town hired Pat Songer and was utilizing him and relied upon him and admitted, I had the testimony of Koberger, we relied upon the information he provided to us in order to make the determination. In other words, the notion that I couldn't prove my case by even the clear and convincing evidence standard, which I don't believe applies in light of the statutory changes in 2015, but the notion that the same evidence that I put on and prevailed in front of an arbitrator was not sufficient to prevail in front of a jury, that makes no sense, and the district court was never able to make or provide an explanation or finding as to how she reaches the conclusion that we don't meet our burden by presenting the exact same evidence that was found to be sufficient already.
Mr. Levine, how do you respond to his position of litigation privilege?
It was never raised and it doesn't apply. This is very, very important. Songer's statements were made before my clients were ever fired, before a grievance was filed. His statements weren't made, his report wasn't written in connection with the arbitration itself. The arbitration occurs after they take the action and after we grieve and go through various steps. There is no litigation privilege. It was never raised. They never filed an answer asserting any privileges prior to the court ruling.
Well, as you're laying this out, at what point was his report asserted?
I'm sorry?
At what point was his report asserted?
His report was submitted well before my clients were terminated. In other words, the event occurs, they have him investigate, and then based upon the report, they make a decision to terminate. Then a grievance is filed under the collective bargaining agreement. Then we go to a step two hearing in front of the town manager, and only after all of those steps are exhausted do we request arbitration. Litigation privilege does not apply because there were no ongoing arbitration proceedings at the time that the defamatory statements were made.
Any further questions?
I'm over my time, hence.
Thank you, Mr. Levine. Thank you, Mr. Guerin. Well, thank you for your arguments in this matter and the briefs that have been submitted. We'll be in recess until tomorrow at 10.